Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again from the depths of a very mysterious and fascinating rabbit hole, which is the brutal stabbing murder of 32-year-old Washington, D.C. area attorney Robert Eric Wan on the night of August 2nd, 2006. So let's get rolling on this one right away with some facts about the case at hand. And right from the start, this one gets a little controversial and misleading. A lot of assumptions have been made in this case, and speculation runs wild. Now, to place it in context, the issue is that Robert lives in suburban Oakton, Virginia, but works in downtown D.C. So in this particular night, he's decided to stay close to the office and has contacted a college buddy who resides about 1 mile from there. Of course, it's not entirely clear why Robert isn't staying at home with his wife that night, but this isn't a spontaneous thing. He makes a plan to sleep at the upscale townhome, or row home, of Joe Price, another successful attorney in the area. Joe is a gay man who lives with his longtime partner of 10 years, Victor Zaborski, in addition to a third man named Dylan Ward, someone who was later brought into the relationship to form a variation on a thruple, or truple, which would be a romantic triad in which all three are sexual partners. Now, the difference with these guys is that Joe and Victor are in a committed relationship, while Dylan operates exclusively within a sexual relationship with Joe. So basically, Joe is the dominant partner in his relationship with Victor, who is the most effeminate of the three. And then Joe and Dylan are involved in the aforementioned sexual relationship, in which Dylan is sexually dominant over Joe. But in totality, Joe Price is the dominant partner of this trio, while Victor and Dylan are submissive to him in terms of the familial construction outside of sex. If this were a family born of a heterosexual relationship, the easiest comparison to make would be that Joe Price is the father, Victor is his wife, and Dylan is their son. That's how the relationship plays out, simply for the sake of practicality. And making this distinction is very important to the case because it's going to reveal an enormous amount of truth about the actions taken in the aftermath of the crime, to the point certain behaviors become predictable just by placing the psychology of the thruple template right on top of them and finding a perfect match. Of course, the elephant in the room is the question of Robert Wan's sexuality, and specifically because it answers not only why he decided to stay at the residence that night, but, more importantly, if the sexual act that preceded his death was consensual. Because the thruple claims an intruder entered the home and stabbed Robert with one of their kitchen knives before fleeing. But the scene inside the home suggests otherwise. It says the killer was already in there. Now, by all accounts, Robert was a happily married heterosexual man, but that certainly doesn't mean he couldn't have engaged in a homosexual lifestyle on occasion. If true, it wouldn't be the first time any of us learned of such a thing. Of course, Joe Price and Robert met in college when Robert visited William and Mary and received Joe as a tour guide assigned to show him around. The two became friends, and in the aftermath, Robert was known to have participated in events that were related to activism in the gay community. That's certainly not an indication of his sexuality, but it would be fair to say that he had friends who were gay, and on this night, specifically chose to stay with multiple gay men who, we're going to learn, own a diverse selection of sex toys and related instruments. Robert's only going to be here for one night, and it doesn't seem unrealistic for him to stay at home in Virginia, as per usual, so we could say it's possible he intentionally chose this place over another. Or did he? Because the evidence suggests Robert also requested to stay with a woman he knew in the area, but she turned him down. Now, we don't really have any context for this event, so we could look at it a few ways. The first would be that Robert is a straight man who just needed a place to stay at this woman's home and had no ulterior motives related to sex. As an extension of that, once she turned him down, he then asked his college friend Joe Price, also in the absence of sexual considerations. Conversely, we could also say he's potentially bisexual, even though his wife suggests he's 100% heterosexual, and that he chose to stay with Joe Price for a sexual motive in place of his initial choice, who was a woman. Nobody really knows. We can speculate all we want about Robert's sexuality, but perhaps the better way to go about it is to follow the evidence, which is no easy task in this case, as tampering, misdirection, and lies come into the fold right from the start. But again, Robert was involved in a sexual act, so we should determine if he gave consent. Now, before the crime even takes place, my opinion is that Robert more than likely did not go to Joe Price's home that night seeking to get involved in a sexual situation. That is, if the story of him attempting to find other lodging first is true. If he contacted somebody else prior to Joe Price, especially a woman, it specifically means he preferred that accommodation. When you're looking for sex, you don't try to make plans with somebody you don't want to sleep with. So, while it's quite possible Robert Wan indulged in such outside of his marriage, there's no proof. Now, the story goes that Robert had planned to work late on that night and needed a place to sleep in the area, presumably because of his extensive commute to Virginia, which he'd otherwise have to repeat coming back the other way early the next morning. Now, the drive is suggested as only being 25 minutes in each direction, but Robert was planning to meet a night crew working at CLE, continuing legal education, at 6 a.m. the next morning. So this night at Joe Price's house was set up in advance, with Robert working late on one night and needing to be back early the next morning. Anyhow, he arrives around 10:30 p.m. on the evening of August 2, 2006. By all accounts, it was a very casual greeting, and Robert went to his room to shower and go to sleep shortly thereafter. It was a little later at night, and supposedly he and Joe agreed to catch up in the morning over breakfast elsewhere in light of this. When later questioned about the contents of this conversation, the suspect seemed hesitant or even unwilling to elaborate, almost as though Robert walked in and went to his room after the two parties barely acknowledged each other. On the surface, there doesn't seem to be a reason for that to occur, as Robert wasn't attacked until later. But as we move into the timeline here, it becomes evident that Price, Zaborski, and Ward are hiding something. Now, again, Robert gets there at 10:30 p.m., and neighbors watching the 11 o'clock newscast say they heard someone scream in the home before it ended, which would be 11:35 p.m. That person was later identified as most likely being Victor Zaborski. Of course, this scream was almost certainly the moment he saw Robert Wan dead, as he suffered no injuries and was not accosted by any type of attacker. So the general calculation of this moment is 11:30 p.m., just a few minutes before the newscast ends. But the trio doesn't call 911 for another 19 minutes to say Wan's been stabbed. First off, Robert Wan has been murdered within an hour of arriving at the home. He's lying on his back in his second-floor guest bedroom with two stab wounds to the chest and one to his abdomen. There's no sign of any kind of struggle or even defensive wounds. There's also no indication of forced entry into the home. Robert appears to have been stabbed while incapacitated, and the medical examiner will rule those wounds the cause of death. In addition, Robert had light hemorrhaging around his eyes and eyelids, consistent with being suffocated in some manner. He wasn't strangled, either by a ligature or a person's hands, and was more likely smothered with an object like a pillow. But no defensive wounds. How could a man be smothered and stabbed to death with no defensive wounds? That doesn't make sense. He must have been awfully tired. And that's where we circle back to the conversation between the housemates and Wan before he went to bed. They want to minimize the interaction to little more than superficial niceties that lasted only a couple of minutes for a very specific reason. If you listen to the show on a regular basis, you've heard me talk about how people set up roadblocks to the truth by standing in front of it. So the strategy on display here is that the suspects need Wan to be tired and ready for bed right when he gets in the door. That's what they're trying to establish. But think about this. There's no degree to which Robert could have been naturally tired that would allow him to be smothered and stabbed to death while lying still. This guy takes a knife blade 5 inches deep into his heart and lies perfectly still. I can't even sit still thinking about the possibility. something had to take place for Robert to lose consciousness. Many believe he willingly participated in a sexual act with any member of the household. Many believe he willingly participated in a sexual act with a member of the household, yet there's no evidence of that. The swabs taken from his genitals and anus both revealed the presence of semen, yet it belonged to Robert. So on top of everything else, we have to believe that Robert came to the home so tired that he fell asleep and got murdered without moving, but was somehow inspired to bring himself to orgasm beforehand. Something doesn't work here. And if I may, the name of that something is white privilege. I'm about to dissect one of the more shameful displays of forgiveness in recent memory, a total abomination of justice. We'll hear about yet another group of white people fabricating another false intruder, backed by their money and influence, who walk through a field of shit and come out smelling like roses. But for me, the psychology of the familial relationship makes this mystery a piece of cake. That certainly isn't going to put the perpetrators in prison, but it will allow us to have a better understanding of how the event transpired. So let's talk about that for a minute. The nature of how the world works dictates that any grouping of people larger than two equates to a family, tribe, team, city, country, continent, and so on. In that light, any romantic partnership involving more than two people must have the proper dynamics to accommodate familial function. There is only equality in such relationships when manipulation is present, and even then, it's a facade. Healthy romantic partnerships playing out in a domestic setting and consisting of more than two people provide for the necessity of each person taking what equates to a familial role. And these are assigned based upon certain strengths and weaknesses. In the same way you get a dog and it becomes a permanent child in your family for the length of its tenure, or you get a cat and it becomes the equivalent of a teenager who can be left alone for long periods but isn't fully self-sufficient, introducing a third party into a relationship creates a specific dynamic. So in this case, Joe Price is basically the man of the house, so to speak, and the overall leader of the pack. His partner, Victor, is submissive to him, though these two are in a committed relationship, and Victor is also successful professionally, not depending on Joe. For all intents and purposes, Joe and Victor have a strong partnership, with both men contributing to it in very significant ways. Yet, if we were to try to frame these two in a heterosexual relationship, Joe would generally be considered the husband, and Victor would be his wife. Victor will take a very stereotypical approach to the 911 call he makes, behaving hysterically, exaggerating his emotions, and speaking in a voice that's effeminate to the extent the 911 operator continually refers to him as ma'am. She doesn't know it's a man, even after Victor describes Joe as his partner. At first, I thought perhaps this was a little insensitive, but it quickly became apparent to me that Victor had been playing a role during the call. More on that in a moment. Back to the comparison of the husband and wife relationship, any romantic partnership that introduces a third person requires that one of those people, preferably the most recent addition, takes on what is essentially the role of a child. It's no different than what the family dog is required to do. The reason for this is that there must be an established hierarchy with defined roles. That's how tribes work, and always have, from the plains of Africa at the beginning of humanity to the government of the country you live in today. So this person in question would need to be the least professionally successful and also least financially independent member of the group, as those qualities will allow the other two to retain their current roles within the household. It's much like a couple having a baby, in the sense that you retain your roles within the household, but the baby brings about additional responsibilities that affect how those roles play out, specifically in the form of reducing the attention the parents are able to give each other. What's understood in all of that is one thing: sacrifice. Bringing a third party into a romantic relationship, whether it's a baby, a dog, or even a grown man, dictates that attention will be reduced between the two original partners. Of course, We make these sacrifices because we feel what's gained by them far outweighs what was lost. So in this situation, what might seem a bit weird to some of us is actually a very mature move on the part of Joe Price, who obviously went to his partner Victor at some point and expressed that he'd like to bring a third person into the relationship and do so specifically for sexual reasons. Now, one would have to imagine this situation was born of Victor's discomfort with some of Joe's sexual desires. When police search the home after Juan is murdered, again, they're going to find a plethora of sex toys and other such devices that indicate very clearly that Joe Price was interested in bondage, S&M, and other risky types of behavior related to sex. The implication here, as the partners bring Dylan Ward into the house, is that the effeminate Victor, the oldest member of the trio, is more of a kind, loving, and stable person with whom Joe wants a long-term relationship, but is, without question, sexually submissive to Joe and therefore not capable of offering the scenarios in which Joe wishes to be pleasured. In fact, it's apparent that Victor was willing to make the sacrifice of bringing another man into the house because it relieves him of the burden of playing a role he's not suited for. The end result is that he's no longer going to disappoint Joe, and his value escalates within the household because he's now relegated to playing a role in which he can't fail. Again, while it might seem strange to some of us, this is actually a very mature approach to the situation. Given that these are very busy professional gay men who seemingly have no interest in raising children, sex is bound to play an important role in their lives. So, it's apparent communication was not a problem here, and as devious as some of the implied sexual acts might be, the process of forming the throuple comes from careful and considerate planning through articulation. Joe could have just found somebody on the side and cheated, or several people, but he didn't. He communicated with his partner in what is a very sensitive situation involving feelings potentially getting hurt, and sought to bring another person into the family to improve the overall relationship to a point where it would work better for everyone. Just try to imagine yourself doing that. Imagine yourself telling your partner that you felt they didn't meet your needs in some way. That takes a lot of courage, right or wrong. And it's something you would do only if you really truly cared about the other person and respected him enough to not cheat before bringing the concerns to his attention. What that tells me is that Joe Price is a very loyal man and will stand by his family, no matter what. He's a guy who will stand up and make tough decisions in difficult situations and do so with regard for the health of his familial relationship. Of course, that's the Joe Price we're going to see in full force. He's going to step up to the plate like he's the father of this family and instruct the rest of the group to follow his lead in perpetrating this crime by way of established familial roles. Because Joe Price is a very bright guy, but he suffers from the same white privilege syndrome as some of those people I've previously mentioned, such as the Ramseys and McCanns. So what we're going to get from him is a plot to conspire to cover up the murder of Robert Juan, yet one that is shockingly beneath his intelligence, and even more so absent of self-awareness. In America, most white people don't fall under the category of Joe Price, or families like the Ramseys. Most of us don't have that kind of cash or influence. So, we haven't enjoyed the full extent of what would commonly be referred to as white privilege. I mean, if I did what the Ramseys did, they would have thrown my ass in prison and tossed away the key. I have that self-awareness because I haven't lived a life where money and influence has allowed me to be ignorant of what other people experience. White privilege and lack of self-awareness exist simultaneously and fuel ignorance in everyday life. So if you exist in that vacuum, when a serious problem arises, guess what is exactly the manner in which you'll deal with it? That's right, white privilege and lack of self-awareness. Joe Price will go full steam on these concepts with the police and judicial system and do so in the absence of possessing the intellect required to disguise his thought process as anything other than a transparent hoax that, in no way, presents evidence an intruder killed Robert Juan. But with that said, these concepts are going to get them out of trouble. And that's what Joe does know. If they feign ignorance and indulge white privilege, he fully believes they're going to escape culpability for this murder. Sadly, he's 100% correct, at least from the standpoint of criminal punishment. Now, to understand why Joe will be the one orchestrating this cover-up, we move to an examination of the final relationship within the throuple, which is the nature of the sexual partnership between Joe Price and Dylan Ward. So, in order for Joe to be satisfied sexually, again, he's seeking somebody who's dominant to him. In that light, with Dylan being the sexual alpha, the situation only works if he's submissive to Joe in terms of his professional and societal influence. And he is. Joe is clearly the more stable, mature, hardworking of the two, a career-minded individual who stands in contrast to Dylan's more free-spirited ways, including an interest in literature, massage, and other endeavors more so related to nurture and understanding than money. Joe can afford Dylan a lifestyle he otherwise wouldn't be able to accommodate within his own means. So they need each other. Joe needs Dylan for the purpose of acquiring things related to nurture, specifically sex, and Dylan needs Joe for things related to getting by in life, such as a good home with solid finances and a family structure. So whereas Victor is a more self-sufficient professional than Dylan, but still has a nurturing relationship with Joe, one where he's sexually submissive, his role in the relationship is molded to be consistent with what would be a wife in a heterosexual relationship. Dylan, meanwhile, who is not self-sufficient to an extent he could live the same lifestyle on his own, then becomes the child. What this means is that, in all matters that take place within the household, Joe Price is unquestionably the alpha, except when it comes to sex. And that's going to reveal what happened in this case. The psychology of this event is a trail of breadcrumbs from start to finish. It's entirely evident that Joe Price brought Dylan Ward into the household for one specific reason. The sex with Victor wasn't cutting it. So we need to examine why. And not even to any great depth. We just need a cursory look at the situation. What that reveals, by way of the abundance of sex toys later found in the home, is that Joe was seeking a situation that added an element of risk or danger to the sex. Many of these items were related to, again, bondage, S&M, and similar. So it's fairly obvious that, since Joe is seeking to be submissive to a sexual partner who's dominant to him in that way, these toys introduced a clear notion that they were intended for use by Dylan Ward in sexual acts performed upon Joe Price. Furthermore, Victor allowing Dylan into the relationship because he's sexually submissive to Joe and can't be the dominant sexual partner Joe needs, indicates that the toys clearly are not being used by Victor to dominate other people. With Victor being submissive to everybody, and Joe being sexually submissive to Dylan, the only logical conclusion is that Dylan's singular value in this household is his sexual dominance. He falls short of the other men in every possible way. But make no mistake, that's why Dylan is here, to assert his sexual dominance. And guess how Robert Wan dies? In an act predicated upon sexual dominance. So let's revisit Robert's arrival at the home again. He gets there at 10:30 p.m. and presumably doesn't know Dylan Ward at this point, or at least hasn't met him. Even if he has, one thing becomes apparent when walking into the house. Dylan is little more than a sex toy in his own right, to the perception of the outside world. To his partners within the house, he has a clearly defined role with value that allows him to be a dominant male. But then Robert shows up one night, and it instantly becomes apparent to Dylan that he's totally outmatched by the professional and societal accomplishments of the other men. Undoubtedly, Joe greeted Robert as a mutually respected peer in his profession. Both were attorneys, and Victor was a part of this professional world as well, although in a slightly different way. This would have left Dylan feeling small as soon as Robert entered the house, simply for the fact that Dylan, for the moment, would have been excised from the throuple in favor of allowing Robert to temporarily demand the attention in his place. Accordingly, Dylan has no way to garner respect in this household except by manner of dominating in the context of sexual acts. That's all he's good for. So when Robert enters the home, he essentially dominates Dylan by taking Joe's attention, as Joe would obviously be happy to connect with his old friend from college. With no other manner of recourse for Dylan to reestablish household dominance, he must rely on sexuality to do so, and Robert has to be the target. In his own mind, in terms of perception, sexual dominance over Robert will put him back at the top of the mountain, so to speak, but therein lies the problem. Robert Wan is not interested in being sexually dominated by Dylan Ward. And guess what that makes him, as he has just invaded the home and taken a room down the hallway from Dylan? It makes him a threat. Robert Wan has moved in on Dylan's territory and is immune to the nature of his sexual dominance by way of being heterosexual. That is the helplessness that causes the situation. Dylan can't fix the one thing that is obviously haunting him in his life. He's not an adult. Or at least, he's not respected as one, and believes that assertion is accurate because he specifically seeks situations in which he'll be perceived as a kid. So to give you an example of how this works, I want you to think back to your childhood for a moment. Think of your relationship with your parents, or whomever existed in the role of a parent in your life, and then try to think of those times when you were a child, alone with that person, and in your conversations, you felt like they respected you, considered your feelings, and believed you had intelligent ideas. But then suddenly another adult, or a group of adults, enters the situation, and very quickly the respect you were afforded is retracted and given to the other adult or adults in favor of relegating you to a role of being an ignorant child who's unaware of the plight of the adults around you. You feel shut out and abandoned. But it happens due to one very important factor. Respect can only be earned. And that's a hard lesson Dylan Ward is about to learn. You can't take respect. If you're a child and feel as though adults don't respect you enough, the solution is simple. Just grow the hell up, and the problem goes away over the course of time. But if you don't mature, you'll end up relying on your physicality as an alternate means of evaluating your manhood because it can offer instant gratification. For instance, Dylan can sexually dominate Joe in a couple of minutes, but a lifetime of hard work would still leave him in the dust professionally. All of which is to say, Dylan Ward was terribly outmatched on this night by Robert Wan, who temporarily stole his dominance and earned a spot in the home, even if just for a night. To get even, Dylan only has one option: to sexually dominate Robert. He certainly isn't going to kick his ass in the workplace, or in any other area of life for that matter. Dylan is sort of a loser. But just like would be the case with a child, once this misguided act takes place, and Dylan realizes his ignorance and the fallout amounting to Robert's death, guess where he's going to run first? That's right, to Mom and Dad. Accordingly, Joe and Victor will be the ones who handle the backlash, while Dylan basically remains silent. Just like a poorly behaved kid sitting outside the principal's office as his parents negotiate everybody's fate behind closed doors. That's Dylan Ward on this night. Watch it happen. Right from the start, Price will have eliminated him from involvement because he's the child, so the parents Price and Zaborski are going to handle it. It's fascinating and undeniable in the way it transpires so naturally. So now that we've set up the relationships, let's discuss a bit of the 911 call. To set up how the call initiates, here's what you need to know. According to Price and Zaborski, who are in a bedroom on the third floor, they hear the jingle from their security system that indicates somebody went in or out the back door on the first floor, whom they believe might be the female tenant who stays in the finished basement apartment. Then they hear a scream, or grunts, coming from downstairs in Robert's bedroom on the second floor. At that point, they get out of bed and hurry down there. The two of them enter Robert's bedroom, and that's when they discover he's been murdered, supposedly by the intruder who just left. Meanwhile, of course, Dylan Ward apparently doesn't hear the scream because he took a sleeping pill, even though his bedroom is located on the same floor as Robert's. It's evident this charade is already being orchestrated, as Dylan Ward would wake up if Robert Wan screamed from being stabbed to death. But I guess I have to mention one thing about that. it's just a little bit difficult to scream from getting murdered in a situation where the evidence shows your body didn't even react to taking a 5-inch blade to the heart and abdomen. Victor suggests to the 911 operator that there was somebody inside their house, and ends the sentence with the word evidently. The definition of evidently is as follows. Plainly or obviously, in a way that is clearly seen or understood. Yet, what the police find is evidence that suggests something entirely to the contrary took place. The knife found at the scene barely has any blood on it, and its blade doesn't match the wounds, indicating somebody disposed of the murder weapon and left a bogus replacement. That knife showed fibers from a towel nearby, which had blood on it, suggesting the way the small amount of blood present got there in the first place was by wiping it on the towel rather than plunging it 5 inches into Robert's chest. Plus, Joe also claims he found the knife on top of Robert's torso and then moved it before police found it at the scene. Furthermore, while the holes on the t-shirt Robert was wearing matched the opening of the wounds, there were no fibers from the t-shirt present inside the cuts. Of course, this says Robert might have been dressed in the shirt by somebody else after being stabbed, with the holes being replicated to match the wounds on his body. A knife from Dylan Ward's cutlery set was missing, specifically a boning knife, and police suspected it could be the murder weapon. However, Dylan's mother maintains that she gave her son that set of knives and kept the boning knife. She goes on to present it to police as proof, but one can only speculate that the minimum of 19 minutes between the scream and the 911 call had everything to do with staging the crime scene, and more importantly, getting rid of the real knife. In the end, the murder weapon is never recovered, and the intruder is a ghost. Now, what's really interesting is that, while these guys have some money that affords them nice electronics and the like, all of that remains untouched in the crime. So what we need to believe is that an unknown intruder entered the home with plans to kill Robert Wan, when the reality is that few people knew he was going to be in this location at the time. You also have to believe that the intruder was able to render Juan unconscious without striking him with anything or even using a method of strangulation. Robert was asphyxiated. He was not strangled. So the most likely manner in which this transpired is that Robert was smothered while already incapacitated for an unrelated reason, thus causing him to stop breathing, or at least to appear as though he had stopped breathing. The signs of hemorrhaging would be visible around the eyelids, and it would be very difficult to ascertain his condition in light of the fact that the hemorrhaging was caused by one action, which is what gave the perception he had stopped breathing, but the initial loss of consciousness was caused by something else entirely. If you weren't a medical professional, it would be very easy to come to the conclusion that he's probably dead, or at least beyond help, before even receiving the stab wounds. So let me just stop there for a moment to point out some similarities to a case already mentioned in the context of white privilege. JonBenet Ramsey. In the same way the Ramseys claimed Burke was asleep in his room all night and knew nothing of what happened, even remaining asleep when his mother screams, we get that here as well. Dylan is conveniently located right down the hallway from Robert on the second floor, in the same way as JonBenet and Burke. The Ramsey parents were on the third floor in their bedroom before coming down to see that a crime had seemingly taken place. Burke doesn't hear an intruder, and neither does Dylan, yet to this day, both are considered most likely to have committed the respective murders in question. Of course, we have absolutely no suspects in either case, aside from the inhabitants of the home. No forced entry. There's a reason for that. They're guilty. Now, Dylan will go on to tell police that he heard the shower go on in Robert's bedroom around 11 p.m. before passing out from the effects of the sleeping pill. And that's where this thing gets even more ridiculous. We're supposed to believe that Robert was awake and showering at 11 p.m., but by 11:30 p.m., he's been rendered unconscious by one method, had his airways cut off by another, and was subsequently murdered without ever being able to mount a defense of any kind. This is clearly a lie, and so I'll resort to the symbolism inherent within. The faucets being turned on insinuates the opening of the floodgates on the issue at hand. The psychology says this is the moment when it started. And it fits like a glove. Watch this. Obviously, I need to speculate in the absence of fact, but I believe there's ample reason to do so. So we know Robert lost consciousness before being smothered, so the manner in which that had to happen dictates only a few possibilities, especially considering the need to use something that can't easily be traced. Roofies, as a very popular date rape drug, would fall into that category. Ultimately, Robert's blood tests didn't show any signs of barbiturate use or similar, and the lab soon ran out of his blood, for whatever reason, disallowing them to test further. So we'll never know for sure. But they did not test for a lot of designer or exotic drugs that you might think would be involved. Yet, in my mind, the way it happens is that Dylan offers Robert something to drink upon entering the home and laces that drink with roofies or similar before presenting it to Robert. Robert soon becomes tired and initially thinks it's probably just a really long day at the office. At that point, he makes it known that he's tired and is shown to his room to retire for the night. Joe Price later admits to police that the group had drinks in front of the sink before this, however. I believe it was wine. So was that drink tainted in some way? We might never know. But from there, Joe and Victor go to their bedroom while Dylan goes to his on the second floor. Once Joe and Victor are upstairs, Dylan then goes to Robert's room, knowing that Robert is already going to be asleep due to the drugs he's been given. After making sure Robert is out cold, he goes in the bathroom, turns on the shower, and then exits while shutting the door. This is a great move because it establishes two things. One, if Joe and Victor had any suspicions about Robert becoming tired so quickly, once they believed they heard him in the shower, it would alleviate any concern about poor behavior on Dylan's part, and render a belief that Robert truly was just tired from a long day. What it also says is that Robert is in the shower, not being attacked or molested in his bed. Furthermore, it's a situation that requires privacy, so it's far less likely that anybody would interrupt the situation if they believed Robert was in the shower. Beyond that, the shower will also muffle any noise coming from the room. So, for me, this one is incredibly transparent. Dylan is acting like a kid trying to get away with something in the eyes of his parents. Now, what I believe most likely happened is that Dylan approached Robert in the bedroom while he was unconscious and then used a device on him that would bring Robert to orgasm in the absence of anyone touching him. Police found exactly this type of toy in the home after the murder. And the presence of Robert's own semen in his genital and anal areas supports this as well. He was found lying on his back, which would mean the semen ran from his genital area into the anus, for lack of a nicer way to say it. I believe Dylan stimulated Robert to orgasm while the man was passed out and being smothered by a pillow or something similar, and the lack of oxygen, combined with the effects of the drugs, caused this level of excitement to require more resources than Robert's respiratory system could offer at the moment. I think Dylan panicked in the aftermath when Robert didn't wake up, and ultimately decided he needed to tell Joe what happened. I believe he sought Joe alone, trying to diminish the importance of the situation in front of Victor for the time being, for fear of how he might react. Accordingly, Joe follows Dylan downstairs and sees what's happened to Robert. The two of them surmise, at Joe's urging, that the only solution to limit Dylan's liability is to claim an intruder entered the home and murdered Robert. So Joe makes the call to stab him, and in the meantime, Victor is overrun with curiosity and concern about what's going on downstairs. So he gets up, goes down to the second floor, and walks in either as Robert is being stabbed or shortly thereafter. But the important thing to note is that the only thing that would cause anybody to scream in this situation is lack of context. One would have to be surprised and shocked. So I believe Victor accidentally witnessed this when he was actually going to learn in the aftermath by Joe approaching him in his return upstairs. Robert was most likely nude when this transpired, having his clothes removed by Dylan. And then they put them back on, with the t-shirt holes added, to feign the stab wounds. What you end up with is wounds that don't contain shirt fibers. That's ridiculous. All of which is to say Dylan perpetrates this act in the absence of the knowledge of the other two men, Price and Zaborski. And the police likely believe the same, because Ward is arrested prior to the other two men in October 2008 and charged with obstruction of justice. The following month, the other two endure the same. What that tells me is that Dylan Ward was the perpetrator and later sought help from Price, and by extension Zaborski, with the intention of orchestrating a cover-up. When the knife found at the scene doesn't match the wounds, and nobody can find any sign of an intruder, you're in a lot of trouble. Detectives undoubtedly believed they could pressure Ward and get him to turn. But in the end, it seems that same move also asserts a strong possibility that the police don't have much in the way of evidence and are resorting to this measure for that very reason. Getting back to the events of the house, though, Price employs a good strategy for the 911 call. Just as in the Ramsey case, Dylan will be kept a secret until the police see him upon their arrival. Patsy never mentions Burke on the 911 call either. Joe, the attorney, is absolutely not going to have Dylan speaking on a recorded phone call. He's going to have Victor do it. Joe decides to tell police that Dylan came out of his bedroom only after the crime was committed and the intruder was gone. That Joe was present at the time and witnessed this. So, Joe sends Victor upstairs to the third floor to make the 911 call, separating him from the body and the other men, because it allows Victor to make the call in the greatest ignorance possible without arousing immediate suspicion. When pressed about the condition of the victim, he doesn't know. When asked what Joe is doing, he only knows that Joe is down on the second floor with the body. He's in a bad position to offer any helpful information. The dispatcher ultimately tells him to go downstairs to the second floor. He doesn't make the attempt to be more helpful by offering as much information as possible. There isn't any reason he can't be in Robert's room with a cell phone unless people in there are talking about something that is intended to not be heard. Furthermore, Victor tells 911 that he doesn't know if the killer is still in the house, but here he is sitting by himself on the third floor instead of remaining with the other men on the second floor to bolster their strength in numbers until the situation was considered safe again. Of course, the cops are going to show up shortly thereafter to find Joe Price in his underwear, while Victor and Dylan are each wearing a bathrobe, and all of them appear to police as though they showered. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But getting back to Robert's injuries, many initially questioned if the knife wounds were inflicted post-mortem, with the case being that they seemed to hardly bleed. On the 911 call, the dispatcher repeatedly instructs Victor to have somebody hold a towel over the wound to soak up the blood, and Victor acknowledges that he understands, but takes no measure to convey this information to the other men. Nor does he try to go downstairs to help the dispatcher, because his allegiance is to Joe. But once the woman instructs him to get his ass down to the second floor, he agrees to comply because doing otherwise might actually be considered a crime. If somebody is dying in your home, the expectation is that you'll seek help. The only help Victor seems to be interested in is the police coming under the guise of an intruder entering the home to murder a man Victor repeatedly refers to only as our friend. So, a towel is found at the scene and is the one that appears to have been used to wipe off the knife. But other than that small amount of blood, it doesn't seem to have been used. The dispatcher, in ignorance of the reality of the situation, tells Victor to soak up the blood until he needs another towel, and then just place the new one right on top. In her experience, this situation dictates there would be a lot of blood. Because if you were attacked in your bed and made any attempt to fight back, the increased heart rate of the sudden, intense action, meaning your life being at stake, would exacerbate the bleeding, especially with a chest wound. But despite being stabbed in the heart, Robert hardly bleeds. Externally, at least. So, while I'm about the furthest thing from a medical professional, it seems to me that the explanation for the lack of blood is likely related to a severely decreased heart rate, and therefore similar issues affecting blood pressure that would limit release of the blood from the body. Again, others could speak to this with much greater accuracy than I'm able, but it seems apparent that Robert's physical state at the time, one in which he couldn't realize the danger or move to react accordingly, and was left to lie still, was one that was ideal for limiting blood flow outside of the body. According to the medical examiner, the abdominal wound allowed blood to fill a 2-foot-long cavity in the small intestine, thereby explaining why there would seem to be such little bleeding from a deep cut where a major vein had been severed. Of course, what the medical examiner also finds is evidence of a number of puncture marks that appear to belong to needles. While this would be consistent with resuscitation efforts conducted by paramedics arriving at the scene, in addition to ER staff at the hospital, many have speculated that Juan could have been injected by a paralytic agent. In fact, the prosecution in the later trial will contend they believe Juan was physically restrained, injected with such a substance, sexually assaulted, and then murdered. Of course, I don't fully believe they stuck to that narrative because it's the truth. I think they chose it because it was their best option to put Price, Zaborski, and Ward behind bars in this case. Robert being injected with a paralytic agent while fully conscious and being restrained makes no sense at all. What are you going to do when he eventually wakes up, remembers this, and subsequently sues the shit out of everyone before sending their asses to jail? This is simply theatrics for the courtroom. It's nonsense. I do not in any way believe this trio of men concocted the idea of perpetrating a premeditated murder against Robert Juan during a casual overnight visit, thinking it would be a lot of fun and easy to get away with. Something went wrong. It didn't start that way. These men could have murdered any random guy they picked up at a club or even off the street. Killing a heterosexual married man whose wife knows where he is does not seem like a recipe for avoiding detection, especially when calling 911 afterward to report the person is dead in your house. This is very much a case, literally and figuratively, where somebody got caught with his pants down. And that somebody is Dylan Ward. He took a big risk, played with fire, and got burned. Undoubtedly it wasn't the first time, but it was the last. Because the bottom line here is that the person who committed the crime needed Robert to remain unconscious in order to avoid detection. When you engage that type of thought pattern, it then also becomes the only way to fix the problem. What I mean is this. If Dylan fails to avoid detection in this matter by keeping Robert unconscious, but breathing, when something goes wrong, that will be his only recourse for correcting the issue, keeping Robert unconscious. Permanently. Which tells me this. Dylan has done it before, and he was very confident going in, because he succeeded in the past. But these are risky behaviors. He rolled the dice and lost, then went to the house and asked them to fix the game to win. So the police tear the home apart, removing everything from a section of staircase to the lint trap in the dryer. They find minimal blood evidence, and the possibility somebody had washed blood off their body outside on the back patio, in addition to evidence somebody had tried to dry wet clothes in the dryer. In totality, however, the police don't recover much in the way of damning evidence, at least in terms of pursuing successful murder convictions against the men. Most of what they find is related to a potential cover-up, and not the murder itself. While I do believe the murder weapon is the knife police suspected was missing from the block, there doesn't seem to be a way to confirm the one Dylan's mother turned over to police was the exact knife in question, rather than a duplicate. While certainly not impossible, I find it strange Dylan's mother would offer him a cutlery set, for which she decided to keep one item for herself, and then somebody just happens to get murdered in the home by a blade that exactly matches said knife. That is beyond ridiculous. Let's be honest. They disposed of it. Now, another element of this case which draws a lot of interest is the fact that Robert was found with a mouth guard still inserted into his mouth. Apparently, he did use one on a regular basis while sleeping, and there isn't any reason to believe it existed as part of the crime, whether it was inserted into his mouth by his own hand or somebody else placed it in there to make it seem as though he went to bed as he normally would. It's an interesting point of contention, but I'm not sure it matters. Because in the end, there's no justice for Robert Wan, or his widow Kathy. She receives an undisclosed sum as part of a settlement several years after the crime. And that's that. Joe Price settles things the same way he approached the situation to begin with. Privilege. The suspects paid their way to freedom. The plan worked. But what's most discouraging is that the murder of Robert Wan remains unsolved. And barring some type of miracle, the situation will remain that way. Yet, if I look back at everything I've researched and try to identify the one thing that haunts me in this case, besides the life of Robert Wan being cut short, it's the manner in which Joe Price could be so terribly cold-hearted in this endeavor to deceive everyone, from the police to the public to Robert's wife. In fact, Joe relays to police in his interrogation that he and Kathy had lunch the week prior when Robert was unable to make it due to a last-minute circumstance. Can you just imagine the two of these people sitting across from each other, most likely talking about Robert and his recent successes, including becoming general counsel for Radio Free Asia? I mean, the smiles they exchanged, the laughs, and the reality that a week later, this same man would be orchestrating a cover-up in her husband's brutal stabbing murder within the confines of his own home. But that isn't the worst part. On the night of the murder, Joe Price was the person who called Kathy to break the news that her husband was never coming home. And according to this man, who claimed to be Robert's friend and had lunch with her just the week before, the death was a result of an intruder entering the home. Within days, Kathy would know that reality was a vicious lie. But there was actually an intruder in the house. His name was Dylan Ward. Joe Price went out into the world seeking a man to sexually dominate the household. He found that person. And Joe Price also sought the qualities of risk and danger in this person that Victor didn't possess. He found that, too, in the worst way. But the one thing he didn't seek to do, which was thrust upon him, was protect Dylan at all costs, like a father. That's the thing Dylan was seeking. So at the conclusion of this tale, we find a painful, irreconcilable truth about our world. Virtue is equally susceptible to growth within darkness as it is in light. The loyalty on display here is nothing less than admirable, yet also entirely disturbing. These three men, Price, Zaborski, and Ward, got through this thing together. They never broke and walked away free in a situation where the odds were heavily stacked against them. Without a doubt, the result stands as testament to the power of the human spirit. But they lied. At the core of that notion, what's revealed is that not all virtue is the same. There is, in fact, one element of that concept that stands far and above the rest. The truth. The pursuit of the truth is an endeavor like no other because it requires one thing: for darkness to be brought to light. We didn't get that in this case. Ever. Because the truth does not fall victim to love, hate, or any emotion in between. It is not dominant or submissive. and it doesn't need a father, a partner, or even a friend. It is simply observed from afar, and never able to be articulated with words. So while the three men who went on trial managed to escape imprisonment by virtues such as loyalty and respect, the reality is they can never escape the truth. Robert's last communication to his wife, ironically, was a couple of unsent messages found on his BlackBerry. They'd been written the night of the murder, presumably by somebody who fabricated them after the fact, and then changed the timestamp on the device to make it appear as though the messages were composed prior to his death. So it seems as though the deception being perpetrated against Kathy was even worse than it had appeared initially. And it makes me wonder what kind of person could sit across from her one day and enjoy lunch in each other's company, only to turn around and unleash a series of lies to protect himself and others in the murder of her husband days later. What kind of a monster could do such a thing? And as much as it hurts to admit it, I believe the honest answer is all of us. That's who we are. Only when push comes to shove. But it's true nonetheless. Circumstance can change who you are without notice. And there's no going back. That's life. It's Joe Price picking up the check at lunch with Kathy one day, and then picking up the phone to deliver a devastating lie about her husband's murder the next, for no reason other than to save his own ass. His friendship with Robert was a lie. But Robert's gone now. There's no apology that would matter, except to his wife. Kathy Wan never got the truth. She's still waiting, and probably always will be. But the virtue of the truth is within Joe's grasp. He merely needs to reach out. Yet, while the record will show that Joe Price is a successful, devious, smart-as-a-whip attorney who smooth-talked his way out of trouble, what I observed was a scared, stuttering, nonsensical man struggling very badly with a guilty conscience. He'll be that way for the rest of his life. He'll suffer until he picks up that phone. The reality is that forgiveness is within his grasp. He needs only to make the call. In the meantime, there will be darkness, silence, and the undeniable reality that his day of reckoning is almost here too. Same goes for Victor Zaborski and Dylan Ward. Judgment cometh, and that right soon.